This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture with me, Dasharan Johan. America was once considered the benchmark of excellence, a first world free country that many consider to be the pinnacle of innovation, technological advancement, and the arts. Many of us looked on with envy. But over the past 6 to 8 months, a microscopic virus has brought the giant to its knees in near embarrassing fashion. Now the world looks at America in bewilderment. 5 million positive cases of COVID-19 so far, close to 200,000 deaths, and an economy decapitated with no signs of slowing down. At the center of it all is President Donald Trump. How did COVID-19 defeat America? That is what we'll be discussing today. And joining me on Skype to help me unpack everything is Assistant Professor Peter Beattie, who is an academic in the field of political psychology, media, and global political economy. Good to have you back on the show, Peter. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
All right. So before we talk about the COVID-19 era, can you briefly talk about the impact Donald Trump has had in America since being inducted as the president back in 2016?
Well, I guess first, just to cover what hasn't changed, basically most of Trump's campaign promises have not actually been implemented. So there's no huge new border wall that Mexico has paid for. There's no renaissance of manufacturing in terms of, you know, hundreds and thousands of factories being built in the U.S. after their companies have moved production away from countries with cheaper labor. Yeah, basically most of what he's promised has not really come to pass. What has changed is he was able to get a tax reform bill, which basically has largely reduced taxes on the richest. That's really his signature accomplishment so far politically. But of course, culturally, his election was a massive shock to the more liberal side of the U.S. political spectrum. Remember, always keep in mind when you're talking about politics in the U.S. that the vast majority of people are not politically aware, they're not politically interested, they're not knowledgeable about politics. But among the minority of people who are, you can kind of split them into liberals and conservatives. And on the conservative side, there was a feeling of jubilation after Trump won. On the liberal side, there was a feeling of absolute horror and shock because most people thought there was no chance Trump could have won. In fact, Hillary Clinton actually tried to get Trump promoted in the Republican primaries because she and her campaign thought that he would be such an easy candidate to beat in the general. So you had this kind of absolute shock on the liberal side, jubilation on the conservative side, and on the liberal side that led to 4 years of Russiagate conspiracy theory that was talked about an awful lot. Very little evidence actually came out of the investigations. And so the most fundamental change that Trump brought with him is a deepening of political polarization among, again, only the minority of the population that is really engaged in politics.
And is there a difference in how polarized the landscape in the U.S. is in the Trump era versus the pre-Trump era?
Yeah, I would just say it's slightly more polarized. You know, Trump is quite a personality, and his campaign rhetoric was very inflammatory. He was, you know, completely outside of the standard box that politicians come in. So, you know, there was plenty of polarization beforehand. It's not like, you know, there's a great amount of bipartisan warmth in the Obama era or in the George W. Bush era. But I think it's fair to say that polarization has gotten slightly more, even more acute under Trump.
So now let's wind back the clock to January 2020. At this point, word of a new coronavirus wreaking havoc in China had already gotten out. I think most of us knew about that. But what was Trump's and the health experts in America's general demeanor towards the virus at this point?
Well, I don't know how to characterize the reaction of health experts in the U.S. overall. There certainly were people who were very concerned about this because you had health experts for many years. I think you can trace it back decades, who have been warning about pandemics. Right. You know, there are a number of concerns. You know, fewer wild spaces means that more humans are in contact with more wild animals, which increases the risk of animal viruses to make the jump over into our species. You have the different problem of antibacterial resistance. So you've had people warning about that problem. So I think the health expert community in January, you could probably pretty accurately describe it as more concerned than Trump and most of his administration. Trump's general demeanor was, this is a limited problem. It's not going to affect the US very much. If it does, we'll be able to handle it, no problem. And at the time, there was a lot of speculation that perhaps COVID-19 would act like the flu and not transmit as much during warm weather or in conditions of warm weather. So I think you could fairly say that Trump's demeanor was lackadaisical. Among health experts, you know, there could have been people who were generally lackadaisical too, or who just didn't think that it was going to be a big problem, but there certainly were health experts who were also very concerned back in January.
It's difficult to blame Trump in January, right? Because, you know, while people knew about the virus, I think everywhere around the world, except China, people were, you know, under the impression that this is not going to affect them. But when things started to become more and more severe, when the reality of the situation started to unfold, even when warnings started to reach the US, like, for example, from the American intelligence, it sort of fell on deaf ears, didn't it?
Yeah. even Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary reportedly had expressed concern about the virus back in January or February. But both the intelligence briefings and the warnings from the Health and Human Services Secretary were pretty much ignored by Trump.
But eventually it reached a point where everyone, at least people in Malaysia, for example, knew about the seriousness about the seriousness of the virus because of how it was constantly being reminded to us. But, you know, even when there was no choice but to accept that there is indeed a deadly virus, it seemed like Trump was very willing to close borders to a certain to certain countries to prevent the spread of the virus, but not take important measures to prevent the spread of the virus from within the country. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, definitely. And that gets down to one of the major causes of the really insufficient response in the US, which is ideology. So for Trump and for the Republican Party, closing the borders is perfectly in line with their kind of nativist ideology or their belief that a lot of economic problems for working people in the US are caused by immigrants rather than by employers who hire immigrants. So closing the borders is not an ideological conflict at all. It's quite easy for them. It fits right in with their beliefs. But when it comes to the actually really important, much more important measures that you would need to take to stop a pandemic, all of those essentially go against the dominant ideology, not just of the Republican Party, but also even among the kind of center right of the Democratic Party, which is currently dominant in that party. And that is, the general ideology is the government should be relatively limited. Markets are the best way of distributing scarce resources. So wherever possible, we should marketize the provision of services because government is just a priori, we know ahead of time, less efficient. So then when it comes to everything else that you would need to do, you ran into this serious ideological block. For Trump, you know, because he was in the presidency, that becomes much more important than what the center-right dominant faction of the Democratic Party thinks. So that's part of the reason why he was prevented from doing things that other governments around the world did that were effective. Having the government direct industry to produce protective equipment, that goes against that ideology. That's the government intervening in the economic system. Spending more on public health, providing health services for people without money. Well, again, that's government intervention. You should let the market sort that out. So this ideological block was you know, a significant impediment for Trump doing what was necessary at the time. But when it comes to blocking travel, that fit in perfectly with his existing ideology.
Okay, we are going to talk a little bit more about this ideological block later, but for now, we do need to take a quick break. But when we come back, Peter and I will continue exploring how Trump and the coronavirus sort of defeated America. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm Dashran Johan, and joining me on Skype is Assistant Professor Peter Beatty, a retired lawyer and a academic in the field of political psychology, media, and global political economy from the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And we are talking about Trump, the COVID-19, and what many consider to be the slow downfall of America. So let's talk a little bit about lockdown. While other countries, specifically in Asia, were willing to lock down and shut down businesses to flatten the curve, the mere suggestion of this seemed to rile up certain pockets of the American population. Why is this so?
Well, I think primarily, I mean, the idea of lockdown, I think there you have, for an explanation, you have to go to Trump's political situation. So this is an election year. At the beginning of the year, Trump is very much focused on his re-election campaign. So his strengths at that time were GDP growth was, you know, fairly minor, but certainly not in recession. I guess you could call it decent. Growth in the stock market was excellent. So he's looking at his strengths and he's thinking, okay, well, you know, if we did a lockdown, that would take a huge hit to the economy, and that's going to hurt my electoral chances. So from the beginning, messaging from the Republican Party to people who identify with the Republican Party or to conservatives was that, you know, lockdown measures are a bad thing. You know, that we could do more harm than the coronavirus itself. You had a politician, I think, from Texas who famously said, I think back in March, that he and other older people were willing to take a greater risk of dying to save the economy, essentially. Hmm. So you had then a bunch of joking memes centered around die for the Dow, die for the Dow Industrial Index so that the stock market is safe. So I think to explain why there was some significant minority of the U.S. population that was staunchly against the idea of lockdowns, the primary cause would just be messaging coming from Trump and the Republicans and going through the vast right-wing media network in the U.S. There's really no left-wing media network that's comparable. So this vast media network is sending these messages out there, getting people to think that lockdowns will cause more harm than good. And so I think that's the number one cause, among others. I mean, there's also kind of cultural aspects of the U.S. There's a broad distrust of government in general. Reasons for that are multiple as well. But I think the number one cause is the messaging from Trump.
And I want to touch on the cultural aspects just a little bit more because, for example, one of the people who really caused a lot of controversy when this idea of, you know, social distancing, staying at home came about is, for example, actress Evangeline Lilly, who said that the very idea, and I'm paraphrasing here, the very idea of, you know, telling us that we have to stay at home and we have to socially distance and we can't go out is sort of violating the concept of personal freedom. Can you elaborate on the mindset of certain pockets of American population in this regard?
Yeah, I mean, the idea of freedom is very central to the U.S. mythology that everyone sort of learns in high school and grade school, that freedom is the defining characteristic of the United States. Hmm. So, you know, you can see how with a population that has been imbued with this kind of political identity, this national identity that's centered on we're more free than the rest of the world, that government orders to stay indoors and to avoid social contacts would rub people the wrong way. You know, they would see this as a kind of authoritarian imposition on their God-given freedoms.
But is there a logic to that? Because the thing I struggle with is that it's not that the government is saying you can't vote. It's not that the government is saying you don't have a right to criticize. It's not that the government is saying you don't have a right to express yourself. The government is merely saying, stay at home, watch Netflix, chill with the people at home, and just socially distance while we deal with this thing. How is that a violation of freedom?
Well, yeah, I mean, I want to go out and have a pool party with a bunch of people. I want to go to a club. I want to go to the shooting range with my friends. You know, my whims are supposed to be, you know, determinative in what I do, with the only impediment being how much money do I have to engage in my whims. But so when that's the mentality, then any sort of government imposition on my complete freedom to do whatever I wish seems like, you know, some kind of authoritarian government control.
But the good thing about America is that it's a decentralized system, right? Which means that state governments were largely allowed to impose their own lockdowns. Can you explain to me these dynamics between the state government and the federal government and how that played out over the COVID-19 period?
Well, I don't know if decentralization is necessarily a good in itself. I think it varies in how it in what it applies to and how it's done. But I think the number one problem with decentralization right now is actually the way that states' fiscal regimes are set up. So right now the U.S. is facing states having huge budget shortfalls because fewer people are working, you have much less tax revenue coming in. At the same time, your expenses are going up in terms of unemployment payments, unemployment insurance payments, and healthcare. But then when it comes to lockdowns and trying to prevent travel from region to region, you know, I haven't seen any systematic analysis of this. So all I have are anecdotes that I've heard from friends in the U.S. And it's just, it's really striking, especially now that I live in Hong Kong and I see how the system here works, where if you fly in, you immediately get tested at the airport. Then you go into quarantine. If you're tested positive, you have to go to a center.
It's pretty much the same in Malaysia as well.
Oh, okay, yeah. And so I was shocked to hear from a friend traveling to the U.S. that they were basically told at the airport, you know, please quarantine yourself for 2 weeks. There's no sort of monitoring whatsoever. There's no enforcement. Same thing with states issuing, you know, quasi-travel bans to people of other states. I have two friends that live in Alabama, and they were going to visit one of their families near Chicago. And at the time, Chicago had sort of banned, soft banned, I suppose, people from Alabama because the and other states as well, because of the much higher infection rates there. So, you know, their consideration was, okay, well, I can't drive into Chicago because our license plates might give us away. But as soon as they get to the town outside of Chicago, they could travel in with their parents into the city. There's no tracing, tracking. So the decentralized nature of governance in the U.S. in this context makes it very difficult to do travel restrictions to keep people from states where the virus is really out of control from traveling to states where the virus is relatively less problematic.
And perhaps the most baffling thing about the climate in America right now is the perspective on masks, right? Once again, much like the lockdown, there seems to be this narrative that wearing masks is clamping down on freedom or, you know, is pro-Democrat. Whereas in Malaysia, for example, you see people wearing masks on a regular, on a regular basis, you know, on regular days, even, and this is before the pandemic, just when they have a common cold, people will just wear the mask and go to the shopping mall. How did masks become a political statement in the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I was surprised when I first moved here to Hong Kong to see people wearing masks. And then I learned that the reason was they didn't want to, you know, spread germs to other people when they were sick.
Seems like common courtesy.
Yeah. No, I was so surprised, not only because that was happening, but because I was surprised. I was surprised at my own surprise because I soon realized, wow, that makes so much sense. Why doesn't everyone do that? But that standard practice just doesn't exist in the U.S. But that doesn't really explain why there are some people who are sort of angrily reacting against masks. That's where the culture war comes in. So, you know, in January or February, I was teaching a class here on U.S. political economy. And I told my students that, you know, if the virus ever gets to the U.S., it is going to be an absolute disaster there. And a lot of my students thought, you know, that's impossible. The U.S. is such a rich and powerful and advanced country that they must have their system sorted well enough to handle it.
That was the sentiment across, you know, across the board. A lot of us assumed the same.
Yeah. Well, if my students had reacted like that at the end of the class, I would have had to take points off of their grade. We went through all the reasons why the U.S. was not in a good position for this virus during the class. But anyway, so the whole culture war aspect, I was worried that, you know, if any of these issues become part of the culture war, that's going to be a huge problem. And all you need is for people's cultural identity as a conservative or cultural identity as a Republican to be tied towards certain positions on coronavirus and measures to fight it. As soon as that happens, you're going to have a fairly broad, but still, of course, minority segment of the population that refuses to participate in any measures. So that's essentially what's happened, is that some people on the conservative right view masks as a kind of liberal Democrat imposition. They don't believe that they work. They may believe in conspiracy theories that this is a plandemic, that the pandemic was actually planned. So there's a whole bunch of crazy beliefs circulating in the U.S. media system. And that's, of course, that was perfectly predictable given the vast right-wing media system within the U.S. But for these people that tune into right-wing media and their whole cultural identity is based around seeing themselves as a conservative fighting against a corrupt government system. So among those people, all you need to think is that, oh, masks are something that Democrats and liberals and globalists want us to wear. And then so I'm going to resist that and refuse to wear masks because that is sort of a sign of my submission to the liberal globalists ruling the world. And I want to be independent and show that I'm independent.
And Trump seemed to do nothing but just put fuel on this fire.
Yeah, well, he's pretty good at that.
All right. And misinformation has also been a huge problem since the dawn of social media. And in a time of crisis, people will look at their nation's leaders to maintain composure and, you know, deliver factual information clearly and consistently. But Trump seems to always contradict himself, health experts, and like a loose cannon, just shoot his mouth however he pleases. Can you share with us a couple of major instances where Trump shared factless information, and what are the repercussions of that?
Well, there's quite a lot. I mean, you could just do an internet search to find the entire list of his statements on the coronavirus situation. I guess my favorite would have to be when he was kind of shooting from the hip, just sort of speaking his, just thinking out loud at a press conference. And he wondered if perhaps if you injected bleach into your veins, perhaps that might kill the virus, and that, or maybe UV light somehow shown inside the body would perhaps kill the virus. So that, you know, that's funny. I kind of recall there might have been some people who actually tried drinking bleach, but then again, this might be fake news, and not just in the Trump sense of fake news, but actual fake news. I don't know what actual impact that had, if it actually harmed anyone. He also was promoting a particular medicine that had not and still hasn't yet been fully tested to treat coronavirus, and saying that there's a lot of promise in this drug. There's certainly, there was a few people that went out and purchased a different version of the same chemical that wasn't safe for human consumption and were harmed as a result. But, you know, in general, I think that his sort of fake news statements, his false statements about the coronavirus, they're kind of funny to listen to. When it comes to actual damage, I think really the only actual damage is him directing or powerfully influencing the right-wing media system to make people believe that this is not really a big deal, that lockdown measures are going too far, that the economy should reopen. I think these sorts of statements of his probably led to more concrete effects in millions of people opposing any sort of effective measures, whereas his funnier statements like, maybe we should inject bleach and see what happens. You know, they're much more entertaining, but I doubt they had as much of an effect.
And while America is suffering from a health crisis, the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor sparked the Black Lives Matter protests. And interestingly enough, for the first time since the movement's founding in 2013, the support for the movement soared. People who were previously against Black Lives Matter, whether it's the regular folk or organizations or politicians, were now in support of it. Is there a way to contextualize this with COVID-19 and perhaps Trump's politics? Do you think the growing support of the Black Lives Matter movement has anything to do with Trump, his politics, the treatment of minorities in the country, and also the way he handled COVID-19?
Yeah, I think so. When it comes to just Trump himself, the fact that he's a very polarizing figure and that polarization has become somewhat worse during his presidency, that suggests that perhaps a lot of people who are on the fence about Black Lives Matter and the movement behind it, perhaps then they decided to hop off the fence and say that they supported it. So that's one factor that could lead to greater support for BLM across the population. But when it comes to the coronavirus, I mean, certainly, you know, there's many, many factors why the BLM protests were so well attended and were sprouting up all over the country. It may have been the biggest protest movement, certainly since the Iraq War protests in 2003. Some part of that is probably a lot of people who were, you know, staying at home, social distancing, not seeing other people, and desperate to be out. So that's another like tiny contributing factor. But I guess the primary one would just be, you know, for the past decade or so, smartphones have been ubiquitous in the U.S. so that you've always had this unjust violence from police against Black people, Hispanics, generally poor people are the group that suffers the most at the hands of the police. And over this past 10 years, you've actually had video of that. So previously, you know, you just had news stories that would describe the statistics of police killings or police brutality. But it's a whole other story when you actually have video. So the video of George Floyd's death was particularly galling, I think, to a lot of people because, you know, he was doing everything that you're supposed to do as a citizen faced with the police who want to arrest you, and he was killed regardless. So a lot of factors. Trump polarizing the country even further probably pushed some people towards supporting BLM when previously they might have been on the fence. A lockdown making people really want to get out of the house, and if there's a big protest, then excellent, this is morally justified reason for me to get out of the house. And then, of course, just the particulars of the Floyd case where you had a video showing everything that happened, and it's one of the most galling instances of police abuse and murder.
We mentioned misinformation earlier. You see, it's one thing to run your mouth on Twitter, even if you're the president, you know, fine. It's another to antagonize allies and key figures when it comes to this health crisis. For example, while people were crying out to Trump to defund the police, Trump has instead decided to defund the World Health Organization. Why is this so?
Well, I think at the beginning of this whole situation, Trump saw it as potentially a way to add to his critique of China and make xenophobia against China a key part of his reelection campaign. So by taking by forming a narrative where the Chinese government kind of uniformly top down decided to squelch any information getting out about the virus and creating a conspiracy theory about the Chinese government wanting to prevent any knowledge about the virus from getting out, that whole narrative, I think he viewed as helping his reelection campaign. You get a foreign enemy that you can blame all of your troubles on instead of looking at the problems in your own country that contributed to the problems. So when it comes to getting out of the WHO or defunding the WHO, you know, that's just part of that whole strategy that, oh, China's the real enemy here, China's the problem, and the WHO is corrupted by China, so therefore we need to stop funding them. So yeah, I think that's the brand of misinformation that's involved here.
And what are the ramifications of antagonizing important organizations like the WHO during a global pandemic?
Well, I don't know what concrete problems that would cause. I mean, Trump had withdrawn a epidemiologist who I think, I'm not sure if he or she was employed by the WHO or the CDC in China, but at any rate, early on in his presidency, Trump had shuttered a agency within the executive branch that was tasked with preparing and dealing with future pandemics. When it comes to the WHO, though, I'm not sure what sort of concrete effect that would have, especially if other countries fill the gap in WHO funding. I guess the only possibility would be if there's less communication between scientists at the WHO and scientists in the US, then that certainly can be problematic. But I'm not sure if that in fact is happening, that contacts are being severed. But it's a plausible speculation.
There isn't signs of slowing down, you know, in terms of how many people are being infected on a daily. Of course, you can't give a health opinion, but from a political spectrum, from a political perspective, we're talking about the polarization. We're talking about masks being a political statement. We're talking about a president who, at least from my vantage point, seems to do everything in his power not to solve the problem. How long do you think this is going to continue?
Well, when you say this, as in a woefully inadequate response to a political problem, a social problem, I think that's just going to continue on into the indefinite future, whether Trump wins or whether Biden administration takes over the executive branch. Because the problem with polarization in the U.S. is at root a problem in the media system, that you have an entire media ecosystem for the right where you can tune in and inhabit an entirely different intellectual world than other people. And likewise, you know, if your media bubble is sort of liberal centrist mass media, then you're in a different bubble. So until the media system is addressed and reformed, I don't see any end of polarization in sight. Then when it comes to disastrously poor responses to major social problems, you know, that's fundamentally a political economic problem, which also involves ideology. And until there's a significant change in ideology, I don't see how that problem is going to be solved either. You know, if Trump stays in office or if Biden takes over, there's still going to be the dominant kind of thrust of U.S. domestic, U.S. economic policy is going to be government has a very limited role in the economy. Everything or almost everything should be provided by the market, and that includes healthcare, whereas every other industrialized country in the world has decided that healthcare is an area where the market needs to be circumscribed, it needs to be limited, and government control or influence or direction or shaping has to be significant. That's not in the offing, at least in the next 4 years. So again, if you're talking about these two problems, I don't see any change over the next 4 years.
Okay, I do have one more question to ask. What does America need to do to recover from this? And by recover, I'm not just talking about flattening the curve. I'm talking about restoring its image politically and in terms of the ideals of America in the eyes of the global population.
Well, I think the number one thing would be to create an industrial policy. Right now, the U.S. has an industrial policy, but it's basically just run through the Pentagon. So any sort of basic research, basic scientific research is done through the Department of Defense, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration. You don't, however, have large-scale planning in the economic system overall. Again, this is tied to ideology. The belief is that if government stays away, the market will itself create a kind of perfect structure to satisfy every need that the society has. That ideology has not done so well against reality over the past 20 years, especially. So that could very well change. Right now, there's all sorts of signs that people who were once true believers in this ideology are beginning to doubt it and are viewing a much stronger role for the government and the economy as a good thing. So I think in order to really solve the underlying weaknesses in the U.S., you would need a healthcare system. First of all, a healthcare system. The what exists in the U.S. I don't think fairly could be called a system. But you would need a government-run or government-administered healthcare system the same as exists in every other industrialized country. That's just for medical care. But another issue that the coronavirus brought to the forefront is global supply chains and how fragile the global economic system is to shocks like this one. So you would need to have basically the whole system reorganized away from a certain kind of efficiency, basically the cheapest sources for everything, labor being the number one cost for many businesses. That means that lots of manufacturing tasks get sent to countries with very low paid workers and so shipped to another country. Countries like Korea and Japan and Germany will send, you know, the high tech components. They'll typically be manufactured in China, shipped around the world. Well, this coronavirus pandemic showed the problems of that highly efficient but very non-resilient system. Hmm. So that would be another part of an industrial policy that the U.S. would have to adopt in order to, you know, be stronger and more resilient. An industrial policy that looks at important products like pharmaceuticals, like respirators, et cetera, looks at their current supply chains and then actually plans to make sure that there's either a separate system to make the same products that's centered in the U.S. or a more resilient system that has fewer, you know, stops along the supply chain. But overall, to answer your question, it would just be a more active role for government, and that role would have to have as its goal a more equitable system where everyone has access to the basics of life, most pressingly healthcare. And that still doesn't exist in the U.S. The most recent estimate, I think it was a study from 2 years ago, found that 45,000 people die every year from lack of healthcare. So, you know, this is the sort of thing that the U.S. would really have to change in order to head off the next challenge.
Well, I do hope the United States recovers from this slump and, you know, becomes the glorious giant that it once was. Thank you so much for joining me today, Peter.
Thank you, Dashran.
All right, that was Assistant Professor Peter Beattie, an academic in the field of political psychology, media, and global political economy from the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And we were having a discussion on Donald Trump, COVID-19, and the downfall of the once glorious America. So if you missed any part of this conversation or previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out our podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or on Spotify. Once again, I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.